Welcome to Poems for Company. I'm your host, Brian Dillon. When we float through our memories, inevitably, we think of certain friends, the shared activities, the camaraderie, the goofiness, and friendships maintained before we entered adulthood with all the serious requirements expected of us as we mature might be privileged in our memories. Today's show features three poems depicting friendship from various angles, and each first-person speaker discloses personal qualities that allow us to evaluate their role as a friend. Here's an excerpt from an ancient Greek poem. The speaker responds to news of the death of his poet friend named Heraclitus. No, not the ancient Greek philosopher Heraclitus, not the one who said you can't step into the same river twice, but a poet of the same name. Here's the excerpt, quotes. They told me, Heraclitus, they told me you were dead. They brought me bitter news to hear and bitter tears to shed. I wept as I remembered how often you and I had tired the sun with talking and sent him down the sky. The speaker recalls his non-stop animated dialogues with his poet friend. They'd talk through the day past sundown. The speaker does not specify the content of their exchanges, but instead the ever-flowing intimacy shared as they exchanged one idea after another. Friendship depends upon dialogue. If we're fortunate, the conversation continues day after day, year after year. But I don't want to sound solemn here. That dialogue may frequently swerve into the goofy. Ada Limon's 2022 poem, Blowing on the Wheel, reminds us humor bonds friends. This is Ada Limon's Blowing on the Wheel. It's getting late. The light's grayish gold on the hillside, and I'm thinking of car rides from Brooklyn to the Cape, or up to Moon Mountain from the city, or out to Stockbridge that one winter with H and her sister and cousin, and how we called them the Stockbridges. And I accidentally said, have a Norman Mailer Christmas, and not a Norman Rockwell Christmas, and we laughed at how sad a Norman Mailer Christmas would be. Or how, another time, we waited for T to put our bags in the car as if she was not just driving, but the driver. Or how, after T got a ticket on 6 East, she'd go the speed limit but blow on the steering wheel like it was a sail and say, is the car even on? The three of us, always piling into the back of some cab and deciding what was next, which was never bed because there was still so much to figure out, and how someone once asked H if we ever just ran out of subjects to keep talking about, and of course, we wouldn't. We won't. It's endless. Even this is endless. The sky darkening in the way that makes me wish we were wandering right now around New York City, somewhere, or at the Governor Bradford, and not wandering at all, or just talking, or not talking, or being happy, or not unhappy. And this is my secret work, to be worthy of you both, and this infinite discourse where everything is interesting because you point it out and say, isn't that interesting? And how mostly we say, remember that time. And we will nod because we do remember that time. Except for the few times we've forgotten, like the one time when H was trying to remind us of something, and when we asked her what, she said, I don't know, but you were there, and I was there. And we were. Ada Limon's Blowing on the Wheel. In jokes, trivial to insiders, form the connective T tissue for these friends. The speaker refers to friend H and friend T and others and their shared references. I accidentally said, have a Norman Mailer Christmas and not a Norman Rockwell Christmas, and we laughed at how sad a Norman Mailer Christmas would be. Even wishing one's friends a Norman Rockwell Christmas could be humorous if the speaker and her friends looked skeptically on the conventionally devout painter's idea of the holiday. But a Norman Mailer Christmas suggests a dark time, threats, and maybe violence, as would be appropriate for the six times married author of The Executioner's Song. Crudely put, Norman Rockwell, wholesome Americana. Norman Mailer, toxic masculinity. Yes, I realize Ada Limon's humor may seem dampened when analyzed, but some explanation seems necessary. The speaker and her friends could tire both the sun and the moon with their talking. Someone once asked H if we ever ran out of subjects to keep talking about. And of course, we wouldn't. We won't. It's endless. Even this is endless. Then this leads to the wish that the wandering and the talk, or at least the talk, continues to flow. The speaker refrains from making herself the focus of attention. The shared dynamic of her friendships are the heart of the poem. I imagine Limon would like her poem to provoke each of us to imagine those times in our lives when we felt so comfortable with a few others that we talked on and had no fear of being judged as shallow or silly. The speaker's time together with these friends is not important so much for what they said or did, but the simple fact they were together. Again, this is Ada Limon's Blowing on the Wheel. It's getting late. The light's grayish gold on the hillside, and I'm thinking of car rides from Brooklyn to the Cape, or up to Moon Mountain from the city, or out to Stockbridge that one winter with H and her sister and cousin, and how we called them the Stockbridges. And I accidentally said, have a Norman Mailer Christmas, and not a Norman Rockwell Christmas, and we laughed at how sad a Norman Mailer Christmas would be. Or how, another time, we waited for T to put our bags in the car as if she was not just driving, but the driver. Or how after T got a ticket on 6 East, she'd go the speed limit, but blow on the steering wheel like it was a sail and say, is the car even on? The three of us, always piling into the back of some cab and deciding what was next, which was never bed because there was still so much to figure out. And how someone once asked H if we ever just ran out of subjects to keep talking about. And of course, we wouldn't. We won't. It's endless. Even this is endless. The sky darkening in the way that makes me wish we were wandering right now around New York City somewhere, or at the Governor Bradford, and not wandering at all, or just talking, or not talking, or being happy, or not unhappy. And this is my secret work, to be worthy of you both, and this infinite discourse, where everything is interesting because you point it out and say, isn't that interesting? And how mostly we say, remember that time. And we will nod because we do remember that time. Except for the few times we've forgotten. Like that one time when H was trying to remind us of something, and when we asked her what, she said, I don't know, but you were there, and I was there. And we were. H Ada Limón's Blowing on the Wheel. There's a lovely playfulness to the speaker's account of her time with her friends. No jealousies or other concerns arise, nor does the speaker strain to arrive at any profound insight about what she learned about herself from recalling time spent with her friends. That is not true for our next poem by the mid-20th century Jewish American author Delmore Schwartz. The poem's very title admits to a troubling concern. Do the others speak of me mockingly, maliciously? The poem begins, bang, 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 with three questions unambiguously expressing the speaker's high anxiety about how his friends think of him. Spread out over three stanzas that vary from 10 to 14 lines long, the speaker projects malevolent intentions upon his friends, resolves to answer them rudely, and then pulls back to evaluate himself. This is Delmore Schwartz's Do the Others Speak of Me Mockingly, Maliciously? Do they whisper behind my back? Do they speak of my clumsiness? Do they laugh at me, mimicking my gestures, retailing my shame? I'll whirl about, denounce them, saying that they are shameless, they are treacherous, no more my friends. Nor will I once again, never, amid 1,000 meetings in the street, recognize their faces, take their hands, not for our common love or old time's sake. They whisper behind my back. They mimicked me. I know the reason why. I too have done this. Cruel for wit's sake, behind my dear friend's back, and to amuse, betrayed his private love, his nervous shame, her habit, and their weaknesses. I have mimicked them. I have been treacherous, for wit's sake, to amuse, because they're being weighed too grossly for a time to be superior, to flatter the listeners by this, the intimate, betraying the intimate, but for the intimate, to free myself of friendship's necessity, fearing from time to time that they would hear, denounce me and reject me, say once for all that they would never meet me, take my hands, speaking for old time's sake and our common love. What an unheard of thing it is, in fine, to love another and equally be loved. What sadness and what joy! How cruel it is that pride and wit distort the heart of man! How vain, how sad, what cruelty, what need! For this is true and sad, that I need them and they need me. What can we do? We need each other's clumsiness, each other's wit, each other's company, and our own pride. I need my face unshamed. I need my wit. I cannot turn away. We know our clumsiness, our weakness, our necessities. We cannot forget our pride, our faces, our common love. Delmore Schwartz's Do the Others Speak of Me Mockingly, Maliciously? Imagine your friends gathered together when you are not with them. Do you miss them and wish you could be sharing their bond with affection? Or, like the speaker, do you fear you are a subject of their free-spirited dialogue and that what your friends have to say is not flattering? Schwartz's title sounds nearly paranoid. Do the others speak of me mockingly, maliciously? Why does the speaker have such concerns? Well, the poem provides an answer, and the fault is not necessarily with the speaker's friends. The first and third stanzas are both formed with multiple sentences. The second stanza, the longest one, unfolds over 14 lines. It's a raging, standalone sentence. The speaker seems to be seething with disgust at himself. Here, the speaker admits he's guilty of exactly what he suspects of his friends. He talks behind their backs, displays his wit to gossip about others. Quotes, "How cruel it is that pride and wit distort the heart of man," as the poem declares. Curiously, the poem opens with an epigraph from the sometimes inscrutable Old Testament book, Proverbs. Quotes, "As in water, face answereth to face, so the heart of man to man." Well, that's the King James hyper-formal translation. Consider the same verse from Proverbs in a modern translation as a prompt for the poem I just read. Quotes, "As someone sees his face reflected in water, so he sees his own mind reflected in another's." In the beginning of the poem, when Schwartz's speaker is enraged, he declares he will never again recognize his friends' faces when he encounters them on the street. By poem's end, he asserts his own kind of proverb, "I need my face unshamed." We cannot forget our pride, our faces, our common love. The epigraph quotes from Proverbs chapter 27. A few verses earlier in this same chapter, the Old Testament writer says, quotes, "As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens the wits of another." That sounds so positive. A recognition that friends enhance one another's qualities. But the speaker recognizes that wit is a double-edged sword. 5 times the poem relies on the term wit, when, in the company of his friends, the speaker knows he wants to be viewed as clever in his remarks, and so implies he must wield his wit more judiciously. We need each other's clumsiness, each other's wit. We get to listen in as the speaker thinks through first his indictment of his friends and then an examination of his own personal weakness. Let's hear Delmore Schwartz's poem once again. "Do the others speak of me mockingly, maliciously? Do they whisper behind my back? Do they speak of my clumsiness? Do they laugh at me, mimicking my gestures, retailing my shame? I'll whirl about, denounce them, saying that they are shameless, they are treacherous, no more my friends. Nor will I once again, never, amid 1,000 meetings in the street, recognize their faces, take their hands, not for our common love or old time's sake. They whispered behind my back. They mimicked me. I know the reason why. I too have done this, cruel for wit's sake, behind my dear friend's back, and to amuse, betrayed his private love, his nervous shame, her habit, and their weaknesses. I have mimicked them. I have been treacherous, for wit's sake, to amuse, because they're being weighed too grossly for a time to be superior, to flatter the listeners by this, the intimate, betraying the intimate, but for the intimate, to free myself of friendship's necessity, fearing from time to time that they would hear, denounce me and reject me, say once for all that they would never meet me, take my hands, speaking for old time's sake and our common love. What an unheard of thing it is, in fine, to love another and equally be loved. What sadness and what joy! How cruel it is that pride and wit distort the heart of man. How vain, how sad, what cruelty, what need! For this is true and sad, that I need them and they need me. What can we do? We need each other's clumsiness, each other's wit, each other's company, and our own pride. I need my face unshamed. I need my wit. I cannot turn away. We know our clumsiness, our weakness, our necessities. We cannot forget our pride, our faces, our common love. Delmore Schwartz, Do the Others Speak of Me Mockingly, Maliciously? Sharon Olds' 1991 poem, Best Friends, includes this parenthetical homage directly beneath the poem's title. Quotes, For Elizabeth Ewer, 1942-51. The poem withholds any specific information on qualities Elizabeth Ewer manifested as a friend to young Sharon Olds. We do not get a chance to hear what young Elizabeth and young Sharon may have talked about when they were children. Instead, we learn Elizabeth died before reaching her 10th birthday, and that the poet recalls her when thinking of her own daughter, whom she named for her childhood friend. Though typically I shy away from asserting whether certain poems are autobiographical, I presume this one is, as Olds does have a daughter named Liddy. This is Sharon Olds' poem, Best Friends. The day my daughter turned 10, I thought of the lank, glittering, greenish cap of your gold hair. The last week of your life, when I came each day after school, I'd study the path to your front door, the bricks laid close as your hairs. I'd try to read the pattern, frowning down for a sign. The last day, there was not a mark on that walk, not a stone out of place, the nurses would not let me in. We were 9. We had never mentioned death or growing up. I had no more imagined you dead than you imagined me a mother. But when I had a daughter, I named her for you, as if pulling you back through a crack between the bricks. She is 10 now, Liddy. She has outlived you, her dark hair gleaming like the earth into which the path was pressed, the path to you. Sharon Olds' Best Friends. I noted earlier that Olds does not attempt to summarize dialogues Elizabeth and she may have shared as children, but she does tell us this: we had never mentioned death or growing up. And of course not. These two friends were both born in 1942, both just 9 when Elizabeth died. We have no access to their final conversations. Olds avoids taking us into Elizabeth's house. We are not even granted a glimpse of the space where her friends spent her final hours. No parent plays a role in the poem to explain to young Sharon what is happening or how to deal with the sudden loss of her friend. The only adults in the poem, the nurses, would not admit her to Elizabeth's house on her friend's final day. I trust they were sparing the young girl from the intensity of her friend's final moments. Identifying what the poem does not reflect on that we might have expected it to do highlights Olds' strategy. Olds focuses on the brick-lined path to Elizabeth's front door, as well as her hair, which she will compare with her own daughter's hair. Nearing this short poem's closure, Old speaks directly to her childhood friend, as though assuring her she has not been forgotten, that by naming her own daughter after her friend, she has memorialized her in the most profound way imaginable. Certainly, that is a testament to friendship, one lasting long beyond childhood. Again, this is Sharon Old's Best Friends. For Elizabeth Ewer, 1942-51. The day my daughter turned 10, I thought of the lank, glittering, greenish cap of your gold hair. The last week of your life, when I came each day after school, I'd study the path to your front door, the bricks laid close as your hairs. I tried to read the pattern, frowning down for a sign. The last day, there was not a mark on that walk, not a stone out of place. The nurses would not let me in. We were 9. We had never mentioned death or growing up. I had no more imagined you dead than you imagined me a mother. But when I had a daughter, I named her for you, as if pulling you back through a crack between the bricks. She is 10 now, Liddy. She has outlived you, her dark hair gleaming like the earth into which the path was pressed, the path to you. Ada Limon, Delmore Schwartz, Sharon Olds, just 3 of many intriguing poets on the theme of friendship. From childhood through old age, we all benefit from close friendships. So there will be additional episodes in the months ahead on the same topic. Also, I am way behind in thanking certain folks who help make Poems for Company possible. Skylar sets up my show at the right time in the Monday morning rotation at KMUN. Viri rescues me when I encounter some technical difficulty during recording. I'm from the 19th century, so this is especially helpful. Many thanks to these 2 KMUN staff members. Each poem read on air is listed on KMUN's podcast page, and any show you missed or want to hear again may be heard by linking into the station's podcast page. Our theme music is Philip Ahlberg's Going to the Sun from his CD Live from Montana, available at sweetgrassmusic.com. Thanks for listening to Poems for Company.